Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today's guest is Patrick Phillips, author of Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, which was published in September by Norton. This is Patrick's first work of nonfiction. His poetry is, I guess, his first love, and his Elegy for a Broken Machine was named a finalist for the National Book Award in Poetry. His other works include Boy, When We Leave Each Other, and Chattahoochee. And his work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and The Nation. Blood at the Root chronicles a southern county in Georgia, Forsyth County, where racism held sway for most of the 20th century. The impetus that gave rise to this long season in hell was an incident that occurred in 1912, and which we'll talk about. Much of what is, to a somewhat lesser degree, still present in America is an attitude grounded in fear and anger, and even now is being fomented in the current election cycle. Whether we talk about Ferguson or Trayvon Martin or what happened in Tulsa a few days ago, in which an unarmed black man, his arms raised in surrender, was shot to death point blank by a female police officer while he was being tased, is really not the question. So, like, whether Black Lives Matter means anything to you as a motto or as a credo or as a symbol or as an insult, what happened in Ferguson also happened in Forsyth County. But to agree much more evil and violent, reserving for the participants of that county a seat in a much lower circle of hell. The epigraph of this gripping tale is an excerpt from Strange Fruit, an uncanny and unnerving work, perhaps best heard as sung by Billie Holiday and written by Abel Meeropol under the pen name of Lewis Allen in 1937. Blood at the Root shines a harsh and unforgiving light on a time and place in America that we should all be ashamed of. Yet the same horrible atrocities that occurred there occur all over the world, every day, and some still by us. Where this leaves us, I don't know, but perhaps we can gain some insight today in this interview. Welcome, Philip, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, first, tell us, how did you first find out about 1912, and then what happened from that incident that gave rise to this entire book, this gripping book?
I first learned this story. I was raised in Forsyth County. My parents moved there when I was 7 years old and when I went to the second grade. So when I was a school kid at Cumming Elementary in the county seat of Forsyth, this was a story that I heard kids telling, like in the backseat of the bus or on the playground. I had come from a suburban part of Atlanta and had been in, you know, an integrated environment in the city of Atlanta, which is just about 40 miles south of Forsyth. And so even as a kid, I noticed that there was something different about Forsyth. There were no black people there. I heard a lot of racist jokes, a lot of really racist attitude that almost across the board people used the N-word to refer to people of color. And, you know, fairly early on, I asked my classmates, why are there no black people? What is going on here? And I was told this kind of legendary story about how, kids just said a long, long time ago, there was a murder of a young white girl, and white people banded together and, quote, ran out all the black people in the county. So, you know, that's how I originally heard the story.
Tell us more, I guess, about your own personal experience there. I mean, it sounds like from the book, and honestly and sincerely, that your parents were kind of heroes. And I guess you must have been to a certain extent, but how did you, keep yourself from becoming immune to the fact that pretty much everyone around you was a racist? How did you handle that?
Yeah, you know, I was lucky in that we were part of a new wave of people who were moving into the county. Forsyth is now really part of suburban Atlanta. When we moved there in 1977, that was just beginning. They had just built a new freeway that made it much quicker to commute to Atlanta. So my parents were young professionals who were working in the city, and they were part of this new wave of people who were coming to the county. The people who were already there were largely from families who had been in the area for a very long time and who had been living in this really closed environment. You know, the people in what happened in 1912 with the waves of night riding happened in a lot of places, but Forsyth was really unique because there the Knight Riders succeeded and the purge was successful in completely closing off the border of the county to black people. And so it was a white world, and most of my schoolmates and most of the people I was around came from families who had been in that environment for generations. So I think in some ways I had a different perspective on it because I was very much from Forsyth and I think of it as home. But at the same time, I went to Atlanta. My parents, you know, took me to Ebenezer Church on Auburn Avenue, Martin Luther King's home church. So I had these other influences just down the road from Atlanta.
You know, this is kind of an off-the-wall question, but what, if anything, did your foundation as a poet lend to this work? And I thought about that, especially given the epigraph that I spoke of in the introduction.
You know, I think it gave me, it certainly was useful when it came time to turn this mountain of archival research that I did, to turn that into a story and into sentences and to try to make the book, you know, a compelling read. But I was, at the same time, I was very aware that this was a real departure from writing poems. I did not want any of the story to be dismissed as poetic license or as just my version of the events. I wanted to ground it, you know, really have, you know, there are 35 pages of notes at the end of the book. So I was determined to ground this in the archival evidence, in research, in the facts as best as I could possibly determine them. And I think that's because I was raised with stories and myths and legends. So while I've spent a lot of my adult life writing poems, I was really determined to have this be a story that depended, you know, really especially on research and factual information to the extent I could do that.
Yeah, the notes were very impressive. It reminded me when I interviewed Eric Larson and I made the mistake of suggesting that it was historical fiction, and he got so mad at me because he said, look, yeah, if it's in there, it happened. And
And of course, you know, if anybody writing a historical research-based nonfiction book, it's still your own angle on things. But I really didn't, I'm with Larson. If it happened, if it's in the book, it happened, and to the best of my knowledge and with as much rigorous research as I could. And I felt particularly serious about that with this story because I know there are people, and particularly people in the county, who have denied this for a very long time or they have downplayed it. Growing up, I was always told, well, that happened everywhere. That was just how it was in those days. So, you know, I didn't want any of that kind of deniability at the end of it. Once I got to the end of the project, I wanted as much as possible to be able to point to the book and say, look, this is what the records show.
And you know, a lot of it obviously is true because the photographs in the book, you know, the pictures do indeed speak for themselves and are worth a thousand words, but they're difficult to look at. And
yeah.
And the thing about it is like if you look at some of the pictures and then associate them with the story, like Mary Turner's situation. Mary Turner's situation is so graphic and atrocious that I don't even want to talk about it on the air. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was a horrific, gruesome lynching. But, you know, it was a lynching. The reason I refer to that is, you know, it was contemporaneous with the story in Forsyth. And I think she was lynched in 1918, so that happened 6 years later. But she, you know, she was lynched for protecting her son. You know, she was lynched for protesting. Or no, I'm sorry, that's a different one. She was lynched for protesting the lynching of her husband. And so that seemed very relevant to Jane Daniel, a woman in my story whose husband was lynched in Forsyth. And, you know, Mary Turner's lynching makes it clear what Jane Daniel would have thought about and what she would have, makes it highly likely that she knew to even say anything in protest would be to put herself at great personal risk. And put herself in physical danger. So yeah, I think the images really drove my research. Every time I found a new picture of someone involved in the story, I just felt, you know, redoubled my dedication because suddenly these names from the newspaper and from census records became incredibly real. And looking into their eyes, there's really nothing quite like that.
I've always wondered, you know, what brings men, and they're mostly men, to this tipping point, like, for example, you know, putting a sign on hanged young man's foot that says, please do not wake. Mm-hmm. What was it that made these public hangings like kind of a picnic event? Where was the joy in this? Where was the happiness? What What was it that made them happy about what they were doing when it was so atrocious as to be, almost devilish, or was devilish?
You know, it's a very complicated question, and that gets into the sociology of lynching. And, you know, there's a lot of very interesting scholarly work on that. It was often the person targeted for lynching was deemed a real outsider. I think there are a couple of historians who've made a very strong case that people who are not born in the area were more likely to be targeted by lynchings. Often they targeted tall, I mean, this sounds insane, but they often targeted tall men, which was something that the guy, Rob Edwards, who was lynched on the Cummings Square, was referred to as Big Rob Edwards. And he was, in all the reports, there's mention of his physical size, that he was a very large young man. He was 24. And, you know, this was on my mind with the recent killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner in Staten Island. You know, there over and over again, when these shocking headlines have appeared, they've been physically large African-American men. And, you know, that is sort of chilling to me to think that it's something that, you know, primal, that there's this lashing out at someone simply because he's a large man. So I'm not sure I can answer exactly what turned it into that festival atmosphere. I think it was a place where African Americans had been turned into this other, you know, a kind of invading force. Whites were convinced that they themselves were in the midst of, they called it a black insurrection. So there was a real atmosphere of paranoia and fear, and the whites of the county became convinced that black men were rising up and going to punish their former masters, and that there was a wave of rapists and murderers. You know, an army of black rapists and murderers were on the loose. And it's in that context that they lynched Rob Edwards, that they shot into homes, they set fire to churches. And, you know, again, I find it difficult not to connect some of this to some of the rhetoric of xenophobia and fear that's in America today. You know, in the wake of the, I'm in New York, in the wake of the bombings in the last, you know, 2 days ago in Manhattan, there's a lot of phobia about Muslim immigration, about creating, you know, Donald Trump's call to create registries for Muslims all over the country. So some of this rhetoric of fear and the turning of someone, a group, into the other enables that kind of violence, I think.
Yeah, it was interesting horrible watching from the helicopter the shooting of, again, a large black man in the back.
Terrence Crutcher. Yeah, Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa.
Yeah, and he's walking away. He's got his hand raised. They suggest he might be reaching into his car, except the window is closed. And then you have the police officer saying, shots fired, he wasn't listening to me. It's almost, rather than pretending like they take joy in the event, they immediately attempt to excuse their behavior. It's a different way of doing it.
Yeah, and there's a really chilling moment in that video where the voice in the helicopter, one of the other, who's another police officer, and I believe the shooter's husband, a female officer was the shooter, and I believe her husband was in that helicopter. And there's a voice on the tape where someone says, he looks like a bad dude. And of course, what we're looking at then is a man with his hands up, you know, standing in the street. So, you know, yeah, all of this is very disturbing. But part of the, I don't really go out on a limb and draw some of these connections overtly in the book, but part of the takeaway for me was that, you know, there's a long genealogy and a long history to some of this attitude of fear towards black men, this othering of African Americans, and this sense among a lot of white people that they are the ones who are being threatened in situations where it's just patently false to think that those cops are in any danger at that moment.
It's, you know, back then in your narrative, you're talking about, you know, maybe 5,000 people getting in their cars and coming to watch the public hanging in the square. Whereas here, I think what Donald Trump said was perhaps the police officer just choked. I mean, what kind of thing is that to say?
And I guess I don't want, in terms of what I just said when I said that they weren't in any danger, I guess I don't want to be too blasé and suggest that's not a difficult job. Obviously it is. And I think they didn't know whether they were in danger. But it does seem that when you see these videos again and again and again, there's a troubling tendency for the police officers if they're looking at a black man like Terrence Crutcher, like Michael Brown, like Eric Garner, to leap to this conclusion that there's an impending threat, which in hindsight, you know, seems to be wildly exaggerated in their mind.
And if we didn't live in such a technologically advanced world and there wasn't the videos, we would know nothing of this.
Yeah, and again, the videos conflict with the stories. Often, I think in the case of the Tulsa shooting with Terrence Crutcher, I think the initial story was released, and then you, when you put it alongside the video, there's just no way to reconcile those two.
And yeah, and if you go back to the election cycle, one thing I was really interested in the book was your portrayal of Woodrow Wilson, who I always thought of, you know, as being this really cool guy, the League of Nations and all that. And much like what's going on now, there were these promises made and then promises broken. And it really doesn't seem that much different than it does today.
Yeah, that's true. Wilson played a role not in directly in Forsyth County in 1912, but he was the newly elected president. And in the years, you know, from 1912 to 1920, when Wilson, I guess 1913 to 1921, when Wilson is in office, he is undeniably setting a national tone that legitimizes white supremacist ideas. Sorry, that's my computer. That legitimizes white supremacist ideas, that legitimizes bigotry. And he was elected with support from W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Crisis magazine endorsed him over Taft and over Teddy Roosevelt. And they took this big risk because he was a Democratic candidate, and a Democrat had never received so many votes from African Americans as Wilson did in 1912 at that point. And so he got this vote of confidence from black leaders like Du Bois, and almost immediately when he takes office, he segregates the civil service, he segregates the bathrooms in buildings all over the Capitol in Washington. And, you know, in the South, people understood that these ideas were being endorsed at the highest level of the government. So, again, very, very not difficult to make a link to some of what's going on today, when there was just an article in the Times 2 days ago that hate crimes against Muslim Americans are up 75% over last year. And there's a very strong suggestion that you can link that to the period when Donald Trump starts standing up at podiums and talking about creating registries of Muslims and talks about banning Muslim immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, if I was Muslim, it would be very difficult and frightening for me to have my family living almost anywhere. I live in Philadelphia, and, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles games, the football team.
Yeah.
If you were Muslim, I wouldn't go to that. I wouldn't go to a game. I would assume I'd be killed.
Yeah, and I think that some of what's going on also really challenges the white narrative of progress. And I think, you know, some of the divisions in the white community right now are between people who are deeply concerned about the injustice and the violence against African Americans, and then another category of white people who are really desperate to say that, look, this, we're in the post-racial society. Michelle Alexander makes this point in her book, The New Jim Crow, that there are people who want to say, look, the wheels of progress have been moving forward and essentially get over it. But, you know, that doesn't really hold up in the face of the evidence of these videos. And it also doesn't hold up in the climate of fear and the climate of threat and you know, bigotry towards Muslim Americans. You know, in Forsyth County right now, they're very proud of the fact that the county tolerates a black community. But at the same time, there are people, you know, one of the guys running for state senate for Forsyth is the head of Donald Trump's campaign in Georgia. And, you know, he's embraced these ideas about closing our borders to Muslim immigrants and creating registries and a lot of that stuff. So I think we've got a blind spot when it comes to the ways in which all of this is being recreated towards the Muslim community today.
You know, while
in addition to violence against the black community.
Right. And it was funny because when I was reading this on the plane in Charlotte, I started thinking about things, and I'm walking through the Charlotte airport, and there's the shoeshine guys, they're all black, and there's the people who are cleaning up, they're all black, and in the hotel, the maids are all black, the valet guys are white, and I realize in a much more insidious way that there is this almost caste system. And I hadn't thought about it until I was in the middle of the book. I'm walking along and I'm seeing this disparity in who gets what jobs. And
That's exactly the term that Michelle Alexander uses, is a caste system in America. That's exactly the term she uses.
Yeah, you're talking about in the 70s things started changing. Why don't you talk a little bit instead about what happened in 1987 and the march and how that was essentially repelled by the citizens of Forsyth?
Yeah, that was a point where, as I was working on the book, and I had been very much in the time machine and back in 1912 and then the 1920s and 30s, at a certain point when I made it back, you know, to the 80s, my family re-enters the story in the beginning. I talk a little bit about my connection to the county, but there's a point where I had no choice but to re-enter the story because we came face to face with some of this culture of fear and intimidation on January 17th, 1987. I was 16 that day, and my mother, father, and my sister went to join a peace protest. So for the first time in the history of Forsyth County, there was going to be an organized and public protest of what at that point was a 75-year racial ban. It had been enforced ever since 1912, and it was still a white county in 1987. So my mother, father, and my sister were part of this march where 75 marchers, including a lot of African-American activists from the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta, and a small handful of locals like my family were it was a very modest plan to go a couple of miles marching along a rural highway, celebrating the Martin Luther King holiday and protesting the segregation. And they were met by a mob of local whites who threw rocks, bottles, anything they could find, and were chanting and screaming racial slurs and really surrounded the marchers until finally the march had to be stopped. And for their own safety, the local police and the Georgia Bureau of Investigations called off the march. So at that same moment, I had actually been trying to find my parents. I got separated from them on the way to the march and was in a different car. And I ended up on the town square as a 16-year-old, and I was expecting to meet my parents there and to listen to these speeches praising brotherhood and understanding. And instead, I heard a PA click on and someone screamed, raise your hand if you love white power. And all around me, all of these young men raised their fists and started chanting white power. And that was the moment when I realized that I had stumbled into the Klan rally and a celebration of their victory over these peace marchers. And that moment made headlines all over the country and really all over the world. And it was the very first time that this story really became part of the consciousness of people outside of Georgia.
Yeah, I know. And the march, I guess Andrew Young, Julian Bond, Coretta Scott
King. That's right.
I think Gary Hart. You would have thought that there would have been, if I hadn't read this, it would be very difficult to believe that there was this little enclave, this little area, and of course the veracity was added by the fact that, like you just said, you were there.
Yeah, I was there, and parts of that day, as a 16-year-old, that day really shocked me and was a turning point in my thinking about, I had known that Forsyth was full of racists, but so was all of Georgia in 1970s and 80s. So that day was the moment when I realized there was something very different, that this was not run-of-the-mill Georgia racism, that there was something profoundly disturbing underneath the surface of the county and the way that this history had never really been faced. And suddenly it bubbled up and was in plain view, just as virulent as it had always been. And, that Oprah Winfrey came down to Forsyth, filmed an episode. She was a brand new talk show host in 87. And, after the first march, a week later, there was a 20,000 person march where a huge crowd of people from all over the country and people from overseas came to support the King Center, to support the marchers and to stand up against this. But of course, and Oprah came down and filmed an episode of her show where she tried to talk to the white people of the county and figure out what was going on. But essentially, when all of that media attention went away, the place really went back to what it had been like for a long time. I think it that moment may have been the beginning of change, but it was still, not a place that black people went well into the 90s.
Yeah,
I think it was only in the mid to late 90s that it really started to change as the tidal wave of Atlanta's suburban sprawl finally reached Forsyth, and eventually the population just grew so exponentially that the old guard were really outnumbered.
And it's funny because you have the very personal recollection of being there. I do have the personal recollection of seeing that show. And
yeah.
The thing that you brought up and that I remember clearly is when she just was essentially speechless and just essentially stopped and said, I'm leaving. And
Yeah. I mean, she ended up filming the show, but throughout Oprah. And the really surreal part of it is that these are white people who, as she's walking around the room and holding out the microphone, saying this virulently racist, bigoted stuff, and they're saying it to Oprah's face. And you know, these were truisms that I had heard over and over again.
Right.
And you know, Oprah sits there and listens to this about how they don't want black people there because black people don't care about where they live and how they have the right to live in a white community, and a lot of stuff worse than that, but. At a certain point, yeah, you just see this despair, and you know, Oprah realizes this is pretty hopeless to try to change these people's minds. And yeah, I think in the end, she talked to a reporter who said, you know, what is your takeaway? And she said, I'm getting out of here. You know, we're leaving this.
Yeah, it's like there were two things that I guess I recall from that was that the people that she was talking to, they felt they acted as they were being put upon by the protesters.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing. And the second one was the dichotomy they created. They say, when she would ask them why they didn't want those people here, they would say, well, there are black people, and then there are N people. And they tried to rationalize this idea that, yeah, they're fine. I like them. I love them. I would welcome them into my house. I just don't want to live with them. But they they created a sub-race within a race, and it's again exactly like Donald Trump says, you know, I love the blacks, or when he says some of my best friends are Muslims. It's that same thing you hear over and over again.
Yeah, and you know, some of this does also grow out of historical amnesia, and that has been on my mind watching Trump. You know, he recently, his latest appeal for African American votes is he said black people have never had it worse in this country than they do right now. Never in American history have they had it worse than, say, in Chicago, where the murder rates are very high right now. And I saw a Trump spokesman on CNN saying this, and Anderson Cooper was disbelieving and said, you're seriously saying that African Americans have never had it worse in American history? He's like, are you including slavery in that? Are you including Jim Crow and the height of the lynching era in that? And of course, they don't want to talk about any of that. So I think that in Forsyth, there was a similar historical amnesia. When there was a state investigation, the governor created a commission to look into the racial issues in 87. And the report that the white leaders in Forsyth, I put this in the book, the report that the white leaders of Forsyth sent to the governor said that blacks had, quote, voluntarily relocated in 1912. You know, and these, I mean, I've tried to document as you know, make as airtight a case as I could, and I think it's really beyond dispute. People left because their homes and churches were set on fire, because shotguns were fired into their houses, and because some of their own were lynched and hung. So, you know, but in 1987, with a straight face, white leaders said they, quote, voluntarily relocated.
And I guess in
some of our divide really is about two different, you know, if you are blind to history and if you're blind to the racial crimes of the 20th century, then I suppose you might have a hard time understanding Black Lives Matter and understanding some of the protest movements coming out of the black community. If you have any sense at all of that, then it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, right. You can, in a broad sense of the word, I guess they did voluntarily relocate because the alternative was, you know, death or dismemberment. Like the story of the young boy who said, "Let me just make a run for it." Tell that kind of thing.
Yeah. So Rob Edwards was lynched on the town square in the wake of the killing of May Crow. So one thing that's also unique about Forsyth compared to a lot of places that have a lynching. And a lynching hysteria, it's very common for there to be an allegation of a murder or an allegation of rape. And, you know, Ida B. Wells was writing about this in the 19th century, that she calls it the old threadbare lie that black men rape white women and that that's what causes lynching. One thing that makes Forsyth unusual, another thing that makes Forsyth unusual, is that in Forsyth County, there really was a woman who was found beaten and bloody in the woods. She was allegedly raped. It's unclear whether she ever regained consciousness, so it's also unclear exactly what happened to her. And she died of her wounds 2 weeks later. So in Forsyth, there really was a crime. Someone did beat and murder this young 18-year-old white woman. It's very difficult to say what actually happened. It's impossible to know. What I did find out is that the three men who were accused of this crime, Rob Edwards, who was lynched, you know, within 24 hours of being arrested, and then two teenage boys, it's pretty clear that they did not get any kind of a fair trial. The evidence against them was almost entirely circumstantial, and it looks pretty strongly like their main crime was being the only young black man in the area. So those two boys were hung. Oscar Daniel was 18, and his cousin Ernest Knox was 16 years old. Now they were described in the papers as fiendish black rapists and as, you know, the barefooted, lowbrowed gorilla type are quotes that appeared in the paper. And then when you see the photographs, these are scrawny, skinny teenage boys, one of them only 16 years old. So the story you're talking about was that after he had been arrested and before he was, when he was convicted and before he was going to be hanged, Ernest Knox, as he was being marched along by a group of soldiers, asked one of them if he could just make a run for it. And the head of the armed guard said, look, if you make a run for it, we've got 20 men in this unit who can hit you running at 1,000 yards. You'll just be shot in the back. And Ernest made it clear that that's what he wanted, that he would prefer for them to just essentially execute him there in the field, if let him make a run for it and then shoot him. They refused. And what followed was, he was part of a double hanging with his cousin in this field not far. I've walked around in that field. It's not far from the town square of Cumming, and 5,000 people came out to watch it. They spread out picnics. It became a big festival atmosphere.
It is hard to envision. And that was one of the most poignant parts of my book. It reminded me of the World Trade Center and the fact that, you know, you're there in the window and you have the choice, you know, the choice of either dying because of smoke inhalation or the incredible heat, or you can jump. And that was the same choice he had. And there's a certain bravery to it.
I was working in the case of people like Oscar Daniel and Ernest Knox. I was, you know, they're at the absolute center of the story. So I, you know, they have lived in my mind now for going on a decade. And I was desperate for everything I possibly could. And yet, you end up working with scraps because, unlike the white community, these are illiterate, poor, dirt poor sharecroppers. Ernest Knox was an orphan. There are accounts of him, you know, kind of starving in the winter and getting by just so at the very, very margins of the culture and at the very bottom of the socioeconomic hierarchy. And so these are just people who left almost no traces. And a moment like that, really, I found it heartbreaking as well, because I was trying anything to find everything I could find to get some sense of who he was. And in that moment, you do get a sense of who he was. And it is a brave moment and a heartbreaking moment, given his situation. And it helped communicate, I think, just how trapped he was, and that there was the notion that he could have gotten a fair trial in this situation is pretty difficult to believe.
It must have been frustrating for you, and I don't know if I would be up to the task to have to recreate and still be as loyal as you were to the facts, the lives and circumstances of people who didn't leave a trail behind them.
Yeah, and my interviews with the families played a key role in that. I spent a lot of time trying to track down descendants of the families that were forced out, the Forsyth refugees. And again, as someone raised in the white community in Forsyth, I was led to believe that these people had vanished into the mist, you know, that they were gone. In reality, as soon as I started digging, as soon as I started connecting with people online and making phone calls and searching Ancestry and just tracking people down by old-fashioned, you know, hustle, I found a lot of them a few miles across the county line. I found many of them in Gainesville and Hall County, which is where I had gone to high school. And so, you know, I was also astonished and really heartbroken to realize that when I was in high school in the late 80s, the very last eyewitnesses to some of this would have been very old men and women. And I realized that I had driven past their houses, some of them, you know, and if I had known, or if anyone I knew had thought to ask them to tell their stories, there would have been eyewitness accounts of some of this. And so there, I had a really palpable sense that this story was hiding in plain sight the whole time. I had thought that it was buried so deep, and who would ever know, and how could you ever find out? But the reality is, you know, I didn't know it simply because none of the white people I knew had ever cared enough to go ask anyone.
Yeah, it's interesting when you go through the litany of, you talk about, you know, here's a fast food store, here's an apartment building, here's an office building. It's also the place where this happened, too. That's where the poet in you kind of came out, you know.
Yeah, I find that haunting. You know, when I first started working on the story, I thought, well, how will I ever find anything out about this? It's all gone. There's no sign of it. And then 10 years later, the last time I was in Forsyth, everywhere I went, everywhere I looked, I saw traces, you know, in a street name, in a cemetery, I looked at one place that I know was the site of Cumming Methodist, the Colored Methodist Church, which was a church headed by a man named Levi Greenlee and Joseph Kellogg. And I got on Google Earth. And I looked at the spot from space, you know, and the record, the deed said it was up on a hill overlooking a pond along Kelly Mill Road. And sure enough, from looking at it from a satellite, there was the spot. There was this clearing at the top of, you know, there was nothing left, but there was this clearing at the top of the hill looking over the pond. And I just thought, wow, this is unreal. This is incredible. I mean, it is real. This is astonishing. So, yeah, I suddenly came to feel that my home place was very haunted by this, and that it wasn't that there were no traces left. It was a willful incuriosity. This is Ta-Nehisi Coates' term. He talks about, he believes that one of the obstacles to racial justice is white incuriosity about the crimes of the 20th century. So yeah, that's very much what I ended with, was this sense that I was surrounded by some of the evidence of this.
That is actually, you know, now that I think about it, it is really very poetic, because the meaning is there, but the meaning is hidden. And it takes a certain stretch for you to recognize the essence of what happened. And that's what makes poetry so valuable in my mind, because it goes straight to the heart. Because at first you don't recognize what is being written, but then all of a sudden you see it, and you see it in an evanescent way, you know?
Well, I certainly hope the book has that effect, because I had a deep faith in, maybe this is also a vestige of working on poems for so long, I had a deep faith in the particular, so I don't know how to really take in the tragedy of racial crimes in the 20th century. The complexities of race in the nation are really overwhelming. And I was almost overwhelmed by this story, but I did come to believe that by limiting it to this one place, and I really ranged across, you know, 200 years in this place, because the Cherokee removals also happened in Forsyth,
right,
in the 1830s, and kind of set that's the deep background to some of what happens in 1912, is that some of the people in 1912, some of their ancestors had participated in the roundup and expulsion of the Cherokees. So I had a faith that by, real deep dive, a kind of historical core sample in a single place, that I might be able to understand something about it that way. And I suppose that's a poet's approach, is to trust in the particular.
I have a kind of a similar situation. My grandfather was born in Vitebsk in Belarus.
Oh, wow.
And he emigrated in 1904. And I've always kind of wanted to go back and see where his family's graves might be, or see the street he lived on, because it was also the home of Marc Chagall. So the painting of the village is the street where my grandfather must have lived.
Oh, that's fabulous. So when you look at a Chagall painting, you're actually seeing,
yes,
potentially it's landscapes and houses and views that your grandfather would have seen.
It's always been above my desk, the picture.
That's astonishing.
I know.
Wow.
But then I think about going back, and then he left during the pogroms, and then,
yeah,
there was World War I, and then there's World War II. there's nothing left. I know there's nothing left there.
Well, and I had to come to that realization as well, that the African-American descendants who I talked with frequently helped fill in some of the gaps in the historical record. But and that was vital. That was vital because there was such an imbalance on the white side versus the black side in terms of written traces. But there was a point where I had to accept that this story was largely out of living memory. Because even when I found descendants, I was usually talking to the great-great-grandchildren or the great-great-grandchildren of people involved. The closest I came was a woman named Maddie Daniel, who was the niece of Oscar Daniel. But she was born in the 30s, you know, 20 years after all of this happened. So to your point, it's not in living memory. There's no one, you know, it doesn't take long for these things to fade from the memories of people actually walking around. And that means that where it lies is in the written traces and the leftover material culture of a time. So I became pretty convinced that the story was in the library scattered around Georgia and really scattered around the country. I used the New York Public Library and the National Archives. So it requires a kind of, it's putting together a puzzle more than anything else.
And it sounds kind of callous, but you're lucky that you were able to reach some of these people before they died.
Yeah, and at the same time, I feel, I very often felt intense regret that I didn't start sooner. That if I had started 20 years ago, but I wasn't in a place, you know, I didn't have the toolkit to do it then. But you know, I felt both lucky to talk to people before they died. Maddie Daniel was 82 when I spoke with her. And she told me all about Jane. You know, that was the one thing. She didn't remember her uncle. She was not born and didn't know anything about her uncle Oscar, who was the 18-year-old boy who was hung in the middle of, you know, this field. But Oscar's older sister, Jane, who barely survived all of this and fled to Detroit, Maddie remembered Jane very well. It was her beloved Uncle Jane or Aunt Janie. And she had gone and stayed with Jane in Detroit. And suddenly I had 1,000 questions about Jane, and Maddie answered them for me, you know, in a half an hour. So that was, So that sense of finding people before all of this is gone was amazing.
Well, you say, you know, you're sorry you didn't start it 20 years ago, but obviously it's taken you a long time. And it's funny that here we are talking about, you know, and I'm not saying anything horrible about Trump, and I don't think either you are too. It's just things that have been said. But you couldn't have expected when you started writing this that you'd find this harmonic, this resonance in today's front pages, did you? I mean, I couldn't have foreseen that.
Well, I didn't. Unfortunately, you know, since Ferguson, the wave after wave of this this violence, you know, victim after victim of these murders and killings and all of these things that have been happening in confrontations with the police, it's been relentless and horrific and terrible. On the other hand, there were moments when I was writing the book where I couldn't escape the sense that some of what I was putting down on paper was going to be news to white people I knew and not news to a lot of African Americans. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
That some of this was that the America I was describing that is shocking to a lot of white people is not, it's tragic and terrible and unjust to people of color, but it's not a news flash, some of this. And frequently when I found descendants even, I had to recognize that while 1912 and the expulsions from Versailles loomed very large in my mind, in their families, there were other tragedies that followed. There were other injustices. The black families who escaped from Versailles, they didn't escape into some sort of nirvana of justice and safety. They escaped into Jim Crow Georgia. You know, I followed Jane Daniel to Detroit, thinking that it was at least one strand of the story that ended happily. And then, of course, I discovered that in 1943, she lived in Paradise Valley, the neighborhood in Detroit that was rocked by white mobs who beat, you know, dozens of black men to death, but not just black men, black people to death with wooden clubs in a summer of rioting, a 5-day riot in Detroit in 1943. Yeah. So all to say, it maybe is a naive point of view to think that there's something new about America since Ferguson. I think it's more that there's a new awareness and a new awakening in the white community to what's been there all along.
And,
you know,
when I tell them about it, when I talk to some of my friends, they say, well, they just laugh at me. Like, what are you telling us that we don't already know?
Right.
And it comes, and then I feel like an idiot because it's like I said about going through the airport, it's just something that you disregard for the most part. And then I feel like, you know, I'm as much a part of the problem. Well, it's like what we were talking about before the show began about, okay, here we are, two white guys talking about all this stuff. What are we supposed to do now? What's supposed to happen now that we can just say, okay, let's change it all right now? And I know
well,
that's a tough question.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot, and the best I can say in response to that question is that I think Nelson Mandela's idea of truth and reconciliation hearings is about the best that I've heard for a nation as divided as we are. And I think that where we stand right now is there are a significant number of people in the white community of America, in the white population of America, who really want the reconciliation without the truth. They want the reward of that process without going through the incredibly painful, incredibly difficult part of coming to grips with the past, telling the truth about what happened all over the country. And I think people live all over the country, there are white people who live in places that have their own I know this is true because they have their own version of a shameful history when it comes to, whether it's violence or housing and discrimination, discrimination in housing and lending, employment discrimination, redlining. You know, I think there are plenty of, since this book has come out, I've had so many people come up to me and say, I'm from, and you fill in the blank with a place in America. And they're like, let me tell you the story about my town. And, you know, that happens everywhere I've been going about this. So I think there are plenty of people who have a vague kind of murky notion that something bad, quote unquote, something bad happened at some point in their community that helped make it look the way it looks today. But there hasn't been enough curiosity about what that was and the specifics. And if we're going to, you know, I have followed very closely Ta-Nehisi Coates' argument. He wrote an essay in The Atlantic called The Case for Reparations, and he lays out a very compelling argument that reparations to the black people of America is not just about the generalized injustice of slavery, but about very specific crimes, specific thefts, specific loss of property and wealth and opportunity. And, you know, that stuff's not actionable by normal legal means. So it would require a federal reparations committee. So, you know, that's the best proposal I've heard for how we try to heal.
And I guess if people read your book, and again, although your words are great, if you just look at the pictures, the first picture I looked at, I was like just shocked. And then there's picture after picture, and you realize it's like that movie Django by Quentin Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
When you see it, first you go, oh, this must be a caricature. This didn't really happen. And then you realize, yeah, this happened. This type of pain, this type of torture, this type of incredible, horrible thing actually did happen and happened over and over again. And I guess that's the part you're talking about is the realization.
I grew up around a lot of people who thought that the way to overcome this was to leave it alone. And I've been seeing this, you know, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is the nearest big paper to Forsyth, they published an excerpt from the book, and I couldn't help but look at the comments section, and there were a lot of comments from people who live in Forsyth who said, why is he dredging this up? Why is he, this is old news. Why bring this up again? We're never going to heal if you keep returning to this. And that's a refrain that you find all through 100 years of newspaper reports and comments to reporters from within Forsyth, where people said, if they just leave us alone, this would all blow over.
There must be some type of Greek term for this flawed logic. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's this hope that you can bury it and it will go away. And that this has not proved to be the case for 100 years and still going in Forsyth. And so what 1987 showed is that was after a very long period of dormancy where people had decided the county was changing. This was all in the past. And then the minute that black faces appeared walking along a road, having a peace march to celebrate Martin Luther King Day, it all burst back to the surface. So I think that's wishful thinking, and I think it's dangerous wishful thinking.
Well, hopefully what you're suggesting is something that will occur. And even though I have tons more questions, I just appreciate the fact that you've come here. I appreciate the fact that you wrote the book, because I think that also took a great deal of courage, too.
So, well, thank you very much. You know, it was one of the great experiences of my life to write the book. So I feel entirely lucky to have had the chance.
Well, thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
We were talking with Patrick Phillips, whose book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, is a story that began in 1912 about a county in Georgia that essentially eliminated every black person in that county and stayed that way for a good part of the 20th century. It's a harrowing book, one that I wouldn't call it entertaining, but it's a compelling book, and it's one that should be read by everybody, I think, especially as we were talking about, no matter what you might think, about our election cycle in America now and the anger and fear that it has given rise to. So anyway, I strongly recommend the book as a lesson, an object lesson, and perhaps, as we talked about, a beginning of some remembrance and reconciliation. We have coming up on The Avid Reader, Jade Chang is going to discuss her debut novel, The Wangs Versus the World, which is great, funny, and poignant. And then the New York Times bestselling author Jodi Picou will discuss her latest Small Great Things. And she'll be appearing at the Hilton Garden Inn opposite of Wellington Square Bookshop in Eagleview to discuss her work and to sign on the 25th of October. And you can sign up for the dwindling number of seats still available at eventbrite.com. That's eventbrite.com. And get the ticket, which will allow you entrance, give you the book, and also donate to Jody's foundation. And we look forward to seeing you there. So thanks, as always, for joining us today. And we look forward to having you here next week on The Avid Reader.